Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the Chemistry World Podcast, which is brought to you this month by Mark Peplow, Victoria Gill, Onono Bhattacharya and Richard Van Orden. I'm Chris Smith. Coming up, why we won't be pouring energy down the drain in future.
Just imagine if you could run your car based on the stuff that you flush down the toilet every day.
Drugs and condoms.
Maybe you flush down your toilet, Chris. I'm talking about getting fuel from sewage waste.
A car driven by sewage, not something you want to get stuck behind on a hot day. Also, we meet the inventor of oral contraceptive chemistry to hear how he's branched out into writing books, plays, and believe it or not, rap music. And it's not that bad either.
Yes, y'all, you know that it's on. The rapper on the mic is MC Flogiston. In the chemistry arena, I'm taking home the title. Sire, I'm dire, the fire that is...
The rapping chemist Carl Gerassi is coming up shortly. Plus, we explore the golden age of home experimentation, and a Nobel Prize winner recalls what he did with his first chemistry set.
I ended up eventually making rather large, 4-foot-tall rockets and sending little frogs up 2 miles in the air using that same chemistry. And it was a tremendous learning experience, actually, because we didn't have a book there that told us exactly how to do that.
So that really was a giant leap, at least where the frogs were concerned. There's more from Carrie Mullis coming up later in the programme, when we'll also be solving last month's colourful chemical conundrum.
Every year at my local fireworks display, I always see so many colours being sprayed out into the sky. Are there any colours of fireworks that can't be made?
No idea? Well, keep listening to find out, because the answer certainly had me surprised.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
Now, they say that one man's trash is another man's treasure, and a recent breakthrough suggests that we might be able to power cars with what currently goes down the drain, Mark.
Yeah, that's right, Chris. Just imagine if you could run your car based on the stuff that you flush down the toilet every day.
Well, drugs and condoms.
Maybe you flush down your toilet, Chris. I'm talking about getting fuel from sewage waste. There's been a lot of talk over the last few years about the hydrogen economy, the idea that we can run our cars on hydrogen gas, and that's fantastic. You combine hydrogen and oxygen in a fuel cell in a car, and that creates an electrical current that you use to drive the car. And the only waste product is water out of it. What could be cleaner? Well, the problem is, where do you get the hydrogen from in the first place? And the only viable large-scale ways of doing that at the moment are either starting with fossil fuels in the first place, which is what we're trying to avoid, or indeed splitting water by using vast amounts of electricity. And again, to get those vast amounts of electricity, you really need a sustainable source.
So what have they done instead?
Chemists have been looking for alternative ways of getting that hydrogen, and the latest development is by Bruce Logan, who's based at Penn State University in the States. Effectively, what he's done is taken that fuel cell that you find in a hydrogen-powered car and reverse-engineered it. What it means is that he uses some friendly bacteria to chomp up the molecules that you find in sewage waste and turn them into charged hydrogen atoms. Now, this is all done on one electrode, if you like, in the 2-electrode fuel cell. Those hydrogen ions move across the cell to the other electrode, where they combine to make hydrogen gas on a platinum electrode. Now, it takes a little bit of additional electricity to help them do this. But in fact, once you do all the sums, what you're effectively doing is getting out 3 times as much energy as you're actually putting in. And remember, the source for this is all waste anyway. It's all sewage waste.
Is it scalable, though, Mark?
Logan thinks that this particular system, they can scale, because his team have been more concerned with getting the efficiency right rather than the speed right. Previous researchers have often been looking at having these things that will actually go into pipes so that they can take hydrogen, if you like, from flowing sewage. He sacrificed a bit in terms of the speed that this can work at, in terms of actually being able to make sure it works efficiently.
So how much energy can you get out of one of these cells then?
Well, it very much depends on how much feedstock you can put into it, how much sewage you can put into it. What he's talking about, he's imagining a situation where you could have these units sited at sewage plants. So you're dealing with a very very large but very slow-moving volume. So given enough time, this really can create quite a lot of hydrogen to store it up, if you like.
But then I suppose it creates another problem, which is you've then got to distribute that hydrogen, whereas if you've got a small portable unit...
Yeah.
I suppose it swings and roundabouts, because otherwise you're going to cart around sewage.
Yeah, it depends. This is actually,
would you rather cart
this
around?
Is an interesting thing. So there's this eternal argument about the hydrogen economy, exactly how you implement it. And yeah, my point of view on this is that developing the infrastructure for this and completely replacing a petroleum-based infrastructure is completely unrealistic. You're better off with having specific uses for hydrogen. For instance, fleets of buses, municipal transport, all of those vehicles that do a small amount of driving every day and return to a depot every day. Because if they're all returning to one depot, then they can all be refueled by just a single fueling station that covers a whole region, rather than having to cater for thousands of motorists that want the convenience of a gas station on every corner.
Still sounds like a brilliant idea, turning something which does literally go down the drain into useful energy. But now, sticking with things which are very small, we've talked about bacteria, now diving down to the level of the individual gene and silencing them. Victoria.
Yep, this work comes out of Northwestern University in the US, and Chad Merkin there has created tiny gold nanoparticles with small strands of DNA attached that can target specific genes and switch them off. And he'd shown this previously, but what he's done now is attach additional molecules to these DNA strands that cause tiny little nano flares that show the process happening, so you can watch gene silencing in real time.
How's this better than, say, RNA interference? Because it sounds like it's very similar. You put a piece of nucleic acid in, it binds to the mirror image signal already in the cell and inactivates it.
Yeah, it is very similar. It's gene silencing, so selectively silencing a gene that you want to switch off. But the crucial thing about this is that you have a vehicle for the gene silencing apparatus, so your little strand of DNA that binds to your RNA that you want to then switch off your gene is your nanoparticle, and then the gold nanoparticle can get inside the cell. It doesn't have to be micro-injected or introduced in any other way. It can just travel into the cell.
So this might be the sort of therapeutic thing everyone's been looking for. How do you get these therapeutic nucleic acids into cells in the first place, especially, say, cancers, to shut off genes that we know are associated with disease?
Yeah, so this is the next step. At the moment, these gold nanoparticles will travel into any cell that you introduce them to, but introducing some kind of selectivity to that will be the next step, so that you can choose that these nanoparticles will be able to switch off genes specifically inside cancer cells, for example, as you say.
And one of the interesting things you mentioned was being able to actually physically see the process happening. Why do they think that will be useful then?
Well, that's diagnostically useful. So, for example, if you can use this for therapies, you can then see your therapy working in real time, and you can see your genes being switched off, and you can also see the level of the gene that's being produced in the cell.
Oh, right, so it's quantitative.
Yes, it is. The number of molecules that cause these flares are actually directly related to the amount of gene that's being produced, so it's measurable.
What sorts of targets have they looked at so far with this? Has it just been proof of principle, or are they actually looking at a whole raft of genes? Does it work across the board, I guess, is what I'm asking.
At the moment, it's just proof of principle. In theory, it will work in any gene that you target, but at the moment, they're just showing that they can display it, they can produce these little nano flares, and they can switch off these genes, and they've measured that. But yeah, it's just proof of principle at this stage.
Thanks, Victoria. Now, from nano flares to someone with a big flair for creative writing, and that includes books, plays and even rap songs. It's Carl Gerassi. He's the chemist who's helped to create the oral contraceptive pill, but in recent years, his mission has been to bring people a bit closer to science, as he explained to Meera Sinthalingam when they met up in London earlier this month.
Yes, yes, y'all, you know that it's on. The rapper on the mic is MC Flogiston. In the chemistry arena, I'm taking home the title. Sire, I'm dire, the fire that is vital.
This month, world-renowned chemist Professor Carl Gerassi gave a talk at the Royal Society in London. Now, Carl's quite a legend, as he was the creator of the first steroidal contraceptive pill. But he's retired from the world of chemistry now and mastered the profession of playwriting, occasionally even using rap as a medium to communicate science. His event in London was titled Washing Dirty Lab Coats in Public, so I met up with him to find out what exactly he was trying to portray in his talk.
Well, when one talks to a general public about science, one usually talks about the science that is being done, the discoveries or inventions. I wanted to talk about the behavior and culture of scientists, which is totally unknown, really, to the general public, or else exaggerated. They're Frankensteins or nerds. And I want to show that we're really human beings with all of our qualities as well as foibles. And I try to illustrate this both in my novels, which I call Science in Fiction, and in my theatre plays, which I call Science in Theatre.
Would you say you're trying to get people to see the actual darker sides because there's not enough of that shown in the public as it is? Or are you trying to just show it the culture as a whole, so both the positives and the darker sides?
Oh, absolutely the latter. I come from that culture, and I cannot shed it. I think it is both the most cooperative of really human endeavors and the most brutally competitive at the same time. That is the unusual thing. It's important that people realize this. And I think the unrealistic thing is, you know, to put scientists on a pedestal. The other thing is, you know, since I'm talking to a woman, it's one of the evolving issues in every one of my plays and novels, the role of modern women in a male-dominated discipline, the very phallocentric nature of science, which is not unexpected because it was created exclusively by men who established the rules of the game. Now that women get into the field, also as professors and chairs of departments. So I'm writing about this. I'm writing about the barriers and so on.
It's interesting that you talk about the role of women in the world of science. Some of your earlier discoveries had an effect on the place of women in society to begin with. You obviously were one of the inventors of the first steroidal contraceptive pill. Is that something that has resulted from things like the pill?
I was involved in the first chemical synthesis of oral contraceptive. I'm a chemist. So that we did in 1951. Norethindrone, the first oral contraceptive to be synthesized. The recognition, the impact that oral contraceptives would have on women and really on the world. I think one would be lying if one said all these people realized all that in the 1950s, because no one expected women would accept it that quickly and on that huge scale. And the implications, which also happen, people forget this, the 1960s, always say, well, pill caused the sexual revolution. The 1960s, well, the decade of rock and roll music, the hippie culture, the drug culture, and most importantly, the women's liberation movement, which really moved in the middle and late 1960s, particularly in the States. It was that mixture. You remember, the chemical was done in 51. The approval in the United States only came in 1960, came at exactly the right time.
Are you quite proud of what's happened as a result of you creating such a steroid?
Absolutely. People often ask me if I could do it all over again. Would I do? And I said, the answer is yes.
You had a very flourishing career as a chemist. What made you want to start writing and start wanting to do plays to show the culture of science today?
It was a very logical transition because through the work on the pill, I did a lot of lecturing and teaching. I directed research in this area for a number of years. And I realized there where I really was talking about the cultural, psychological, economic, legal aspects, which are much more complex. And I decided to become an intellectual smuggler, really smuggle information that people either don't want to hear or they're afraid of it or there are no opportunities for this in the guise of fiction. And this is why I call it science and fiction rather than science fiction. But hide it within an interesting story so people would continue to read and turn the pages. But when they actually did get to the last page, they'd learn something, whether they realize it or not.
Knock, knock.
Who is it?
It's me and I'm gifted. I'm binding elements that I'm finding have drifted. Transforming them into everything is so easy, like salts and heavy metals, but not AC/DC. What more can I say? You know I'm the bomb, the only one under the sun, MC Flawless Dawn. Yes.
You said you use things like a rap in order to help get some of your information across. How well have those been received?
Well, that went fantastically well. These two raps that I commissioned, I didn't do them, nor did I sing them, commissioned for Oxygen and for NO, and I've even done this, well, for instance, I did this rap yesterday, one of them, the Oxygen rap at the Royal Society. Well, there weren't any young people there, but they were all beaming and bouncing. Rap is a very interesting style. And if you think about even some of the vicious rap, has some interesting pedagogic information transmittal aspects. It's a very modern form of music. Well, first of all, it's unusual to do it in the context of science. So I wanted to, of course, do the unusual thing so people get interested and at the same time absorb some information.
What part of your career would you say you've enjoyed the most, the part as a chemist or the part as a novelist, playwright?
What I'm doing now is writing plays or writing now again some nonfiction in dialogic form and giving lots of lectures, particularly in Europe. So I enjoy that most, no question. One of the reasons, of course, because you're entirely, totally, 100% involved in this without any infrastructure. And, you know, as a scientist, I love team, you have to write grant applications, you do this and that and so on, and things move on even if you don't do anything. Well, now, if I don't write, no one else is going to do it for me. So I enjoy that most.
Even if anyone else did do it for him, I don't think they'd do it as well. Carl's now written over 10 plays and even more novels, which have all had success worldwide in portraying the culture of science. I'll leave you with another insert of his modern method of chemistry education.
There's many elements, some we know about. The rest of weight still has to figure them out. In chemical reaction, this remains. Matter is neither lost nor gained.
Carl Gerassi talking to Mira Senthilingam about his plays, books and raps. On the way, the sweet taste of success as researchers uncover the origins of chocolate consumption and the world's smallest microwave oven. It's tinier than a pinhead, so even by ready meal standards, it wouldn't cook much. So what's it for? Well, before we find out, to something that most men have got, many of whom probably played with a great deal when they were little, but they tend to have lost interest in as time's gone by. I am, of course, talking about chemistry sets, which these days are being universally received as not as good as they used to be. Indeed, in his latest book, Bill Bryson tells of his disappointment on performing his first experiment and expecting at least a modest mushroom cloud, but being greeted instead by a rather undramatic colour change. But what's the history of home experimentation and what's its future? I caught up with the Chemical Heritage Foundation's Rosie DiVeneri to find out.
The first quote-unquote chemistry set that I've seen referenced in a book is actually in 1791. They're referred to as portable chests of chemistry, and they were mainly geared toward university students. You know, people studying natural philosophy, people studying agriculture, metallurgy, things along those lines.
But this is a bit like a student having their own dissection kit for doing their anatomy classes. It's not the same thing as, say, me having a chemistry set to play with my children. So when did that sort of chemistry come in?
The first company in the U.S. was actually the Porter Chemical Company, who manufactured the ChemCraft chemistry set. And 1912, 1916 is roughly around the time that we see ChemCraft come out with its first non-expertise chemistry set. The ChemCraft sets were first introduced in United States department stores, and they were very frequently put in the toy department.
So what sorts of things could you do with your chemistry set? Say you bought one in 1915. What sort of things could you do with it?
If you bought a set in 1915, it was very similar to the experiments that you see all through the late 19th century. You know, making compounds, making mixtures, making things change color. There were some experiments that involved using some sort of heat source underneath it. They were fairly simple experiments at that point. It was really meant to be an introduction and to get children interested in science. That changes in the late 1930s, early 1940s, when A.C. Gilbert, who was the inventor of the Erector set, comes in, and that's when you see the experiments start to really take off into the wild and the absurd, to blowing things up, to creating, you know, green piles of goo that you can gross your sister out with.
It's interesting you say gross your sister out, because even if I wind my mind back to my first chemistry set, and it wasn't that long ago, it's got a kid on the front of the box with his sort of shirt and tie on, stereotypical geek, and it's a guy, no girls.
Right. It's interesting that you mentioned the shirt and tie. That is something that you see last, up until about the 1960s and the 1970s. They're all boys. They're all usually young, usually have brown hair, and they're all wearing a very nice shirt and tie. They do look like your stereotypical science nerd. And they were very much meant for boys. Girls were not encouraged to think of careers in science. Of course, we know that that did not happen. Women were interested in chemistry sets and chemistry from the very beginning. I have a woman who's now a professor who wanted a chemistry set so badly that she decided to make her own with things she found underneath her mother's sink, cleaning materials, ammonia, bleach, things like that.
It's interesting that you say people making their own chemistry sets, because I think we're going to see a resurgence of that, aren't we? Because hasn't the rot set in where the actual excitement you see in chemistry sets has really diminished? Because I think you've gone on record yourself for saying people are selling chemistry sets these days without actually having any chemicals in them.
That's absolutely true. You buy these sets and literally on the boxes they say contains no chemicals. And of course, to people who grew up with being able to handle hazardous chemicals and getting chemistry sets with that contain uranium dust, how can you have a chemistry set without any chemicals? So there is a resurgence of what I like to call underground chemistry sets, people who go out and they buy very small quantities of chemicals. They get one of these old books. They become absolutely fascinated with the experiments in there, and they create their own chemistry set. Buying small quantities of certain chemicals and buying lab glassware is no problem with the invention of the internet now.
There was a young boy in America who managed to build a fast breeder reactor in his garden shed by writing off to various laboratory suppliers and buying all the materials he needed, and then got 100 old smoke detectors and got the americium out. But the thing that presumably is driving this is an obsession with health and safety, because companies are worried about supplying chemicals that people might create explosions with and therefore end up with a lawsuit.
Absolutely. The boy you refer to is known here as the Radioactive Boy Scout. He was given a book called The Golden Book of Chemistry Experiments, which there's a folk legend that it was banned in the 1960s and then was reissued, taking out certain parts of it because, you know, after someone makes a particle accelerator in their shed, you don't want someone else to be able to learn how to do that. It is very much driven by a focus on health and safety. I like to think it's more of a psychological barrier on the part of consumers as opposed to an actual fear. For a long time, especially in the United States, we were inundated with chemicals are bad. And then after 9/11, it became even more difficult to buy certain compounds. But if you have enough wherewithal, you can definitely figure out a way to do it.
Rosie DiVeneri. And here's someone who certainly had the wherewithal when it came to chemistry, because he won the Nobel Prize for discovering the polymerase chain reaction. And who would have believed that it all began by firing frogs into low Earth orbit?
My name is Kerry Mullis. I won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1993, which was quite an honor. The first chemistry set I had was a Gilbert chemistry set. And it was at a time, that would have been back in the 1950s, when liability insurance and all that kind of stuff wasn't nearly what it is today. And so the makers of chemistry sets could really include a lot of really interesting chemicals, things that could, in fact, be turned into what little boys are most interested in, is things that explode or burn really fast, or things like that. The literature that came with them, they would say, don't do this, you know, or if you do this, do it on a very small scale or something like that. And it was like daring you to do that.
So do you think that's a major problem in today's world then, Carrie, the fact that there isn't this inherent danger, therefore people learn no respect for things that are dangerous, and at the same time they don't have any inclination to want to do anything because it isn't dangerous?
Well, as far as not learning about the danger of it, I'm sure some people probably got injured with those original chemistry sets, but most people, like me, when they said this would blow up or something, I took them seriously, and I did things on a rather small scale and carefully at first before I figured out what it would do. It certainly takes the thrill out of it, that the chemicals that they give you basically are very innocuous things, that they change colors or they make plastics out of them, things like that, but nothing that would where you could make your own fireworks or something like that.
Well, there's even chemistry sets on the market now which don't purport to contain any chemicals whatsoever.
I'm not surprised. The last time I looked at one, I thought it was quite unentertaining and innocuous looking.
It's easy to say, though, if I hadn't played with this chemistry set, then I probably wouldn't be doing what I do now. Do you think that you could honestly say that, though? Do you think that you were just interested in science anyway?
I don't think that's true, because as a part of the same time when people were not so frightened of liability and stuff, when I was in the seventh grade, our chemistry teacher would allow us to come into the chemistry lab after school was closed. And so a friend of mine and I, who were interested in chemistry, she let us into the chemistry stock room and let us set up experiments and play with things right there in the high school.
And come on, be honest, did this actually result in some dangerous shenanigans going on?
Well, probably not terribly, but you make a mixture of, say, potassium nitrate and sugar, and you heat it up carefully. When it solidifies after it melts, if you light it, it's quite exciting. I ended up eventually making rather large, 4-foot-tall rockets and sending little frogs up 2 miles in the air using that same chemistry. And it was a tremendous learning experience, actually, because we didn't have a book there that told us exactly how to do that. And I just sort of had to figure it out slowly. And we made littler ones to start with and bigger and bigger and bigger ones, and just had to finally get to the point where we could put a frog in a little film canister at the top of one with a parachute. And it was quite an experience.
Did you get the frog back?
Yes. Now, the frog came back with a little red parachute. 35-millimeter film used to come in these little aluminum canisters, and that was about the size of these little frogs that were always available in my front yard.
Carrie, how many fingers have you got?
All 10.
So you came through the experience unscathed?
You know, we had a couple of explosions, but we never were close enough to the launching pad where anybody got hurt. One time when I went in, I tried to make a two-stage rocket. That's what they were doing at Cape Canaveral at the time, and that's what we thought we should try to do. And so that time I almost hit my dad, who was out with us. The second stage didn't go off until the thing was already coming back down. And so it went off at an angle toward us, and my dad it almost hit him. So that kind of freaked us out a little bit. But none of us ever got hurt or even burned. One time when I was heating the fuel, it caught on fire in this pot, and we were under a tree, and it did mess up the tree pretty bad. But we had lots of trees in our yard anyhow. So.
If only that kind of excuse had washed with my mother, then my childhood would have been a lot more comfortable. That was Carrie Mullis recalling his first forays into chemistry, and I'm also comforted to hear that the rocketeering frogs didn't croak it either. Now it's time to take a look at the World Wide Web and what it's got in store for chemistry, as Richard Van Norden explained to Meera Senthilingam.
It's amazing that the internet is really becoming flooded with free chemical information of a really quite unusual kind. You've obviously got lots of information out there on sites like Wikipedia that people know about, but I found some rather more interesting ideas. First of all, of course, the internet offers video, which flat research papers don't. So there are lots of chemistry out there on YouTube bringing chemistry to life. You've also got unusual things like blogs, web diaries that people write. And chemists are now writing blogs about research, commenting on gossip in the chemistry world. And there's a lot of opinions out there, and some of them are quite sharp and good to read. And also there's something called Open Notebook Science, pioneered by Jean-Claude Bradley in Drexel University. The idea is that instead of recording your lab book in a hardback book, you record it not only on the internet, but open on the internet for everyone to see, so that everyone can have access to the experiments that failed or the data that you would normally not have published. So in fact, you're getting almost more information available on the internet than you would have in normal research papers.
But is this really useful to research scientists?
That's the real problem. Take blogs, for example. A lot of professors would say, and Steve Bachrach, a computational chemist I talked to, and he says, looking at blogs, it's just random thoughts of random individuals. It takes up a lot of my day. And the same goes for the free chemistry databases that are out there. There's tens of free databases with lots of information on molecules for research chemists. But you've got to remember that these are not out there on their own. They're competing with very well-established, paid-for, quality databases maintained by, for example, the Chemical Abstract Service. So these are providing data on millions of molecules for chemists to look at. Why would they bother looking at the internet for some rather haphazard volunteered information when it's already out there? And in some cases, you can see that open notebook science, the idea of collaborating together on the internet, would give you more opportunities to do research. And that's really what proponents of so-called open chemistry are angling for.
But I've still got to ask what the point is, because who's going to actually go through all of this information?
The idea is that in Web 2.0, information's linked together intelligently by a computer, so that, for example, you want to find out about a molecule, say acetone, you type in acetone and some intelligent machine gives you not only all the articles about acetone, but also the articles about nail polish, which is what acetone is, and also all the blog posts about it, and maybe a 3D picture of the molecule, and maybe a link to an Open Notebook Science lab book where some experiment was done with acetone. Of course, this requires some kind of chemical language, like the internet's written in HTML. The chemical internet would have to be written in some kind of chemical markup language, so a search engine could search for structures, not just for text. So this is all being developed by people like Peter Murray Rust at Cambridge University, who coined this term open chemistry. And the real challenges that open chemistry still has to face are, one, as I mentioned earlier, maintaining quality. No one's paying for anyone to check out the quality of this data because it's all free. So, well, in Wikipedia, it's really up to the users to moderate their own data, and there are a few people who moderate Wikipedia. Can the same be done for chemistry? Second, of course, you need this idea of linking data together. Otherwise, as you say, it becomes a free-for-all where volunteered information is just haphazardly out there and it's of no real use to a research scientist looking for a 10-minute quick answer to their question. But just to highlight one other really exciting idea about the internet is the idea of collaboration. So you have virtual networks, virtual worlds such as Second Life, where people sort of appear on this almost The Sims-type screen and talk to each other. And people already sort of talking about chemistry and having virtual conferences on the internet, and all this is very much in its infancy, very much a young movement. But no doubt the next generation of chemists will be far more familiar with all these tools and will use them as a matter of course. And that's when we'll probably see open chemistry come into the mainstream.
Thanks, Richard. And now, Victoria, we're on the trail of where chocolate came from.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a lot older than we thought it was. It's apparently 3,000 years old. A chemist called Patrick McGovern at the University of Pennsylvania in the US has been using, for most of his career now, he's been using chemistry to sort of put a different bit of a spin on archaeology. And one of his specializations is that he looks at fermented beverages. If you find bits of ceramic that held liquids from archaeological sites, you can age the pottery using carbon dating and other techniques. And then you can also take the residues from what the pottery used to hold and find out how old that is. So you can find out about beverages, about liquids.
So how's he applied this to chocolate?
He's used a form of mass spectrometry on some residues found inside some ceremonial cups that were found in Honduras. So these cups were dated and they're around 3,000 years old. And on the inside of these cups, there's a tiny amount of residue from an old cocoa drink that's, because these cups were sort of very decorative, they figured these drinks were ceremonial, celebratory drinks. So they're alcoholic beverages that were used in special ceremonies 3,000 years ago.
And how does that fit in with the sort of cocoa timeline we understood to be in existence before this discovery then?
Apparently, we understood cocoa to have been a form of currency for old sort of Mesoamerican cultures, so Aztec cultures. But these cultures started using cocoa and trading it as very sort of high-value, high-sugar entity about 500 years beyond what McGovern has found and his group have found with their bit of chemistry. So it's moved chocolate back further in history.
Amazing what you can find when you go looking for it. And on a note, one of the things you can do with a microwave is melt chocolate, but it would be a pretty small portion with this microwave, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It would have to be very small. So researchers in the US have made what is probably the world's smallest microwave oven. It's thinner than human hair and can heat droplets of liquid that are smaller than a pinhead.
Sounds absolutely crazy. Why would you want to do that?
The idea is that you might be able to use it, once it's refined, in lab-on-a-chip type devices, and those can perform chemical analyses on tiny samples. Another potential use would be to use it to do the polymerase chain reaction, and that's used in sort of crime labs and by molecular biologists to amplify up tiny amounts of DNA. And to do that, you need to be able to cycle between two or three different temperatures quite quickly.
So there's no danger that it might damage the nucleic acid when you microwave it?
Well, only if you go over, 100 degrees. So you have to be quite precise.
How does it work, though? Because that's tiny.
Yeah, it is. I mean, in principle, it's quite similar to the way that the microwave works in your kitchen. That is, you've got microwaves of about 12 centimetre wavelength. When they hit water molecules, particularly, because water molecules are charged, they begin to jostle and spin in the electric field of the microwave. And as they knock against each other, that creates friction and heats up your sample. But in practice, it's all quite different. Your kitchen microwave uses something called a magnetron, which is a huge, clunky device, and it creates quite powerful microwaves that can cook your food. But if you obviously you can't use something like that on a sample size that small. So what they've done is they've used a signal generator and they've funneled the microwaves from that signal generator using a thin film. And they've got a tiny chamber above that, which is about 7 micrometers across at its narrowest point and about 4 millimeters long. That runs over this thin film.
So is the thin film conductive? Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's right. It's like a transmission line and it transmits the microwaves down to the sample.
So are they made actually somewhere else in the microwave generating device and then funneled into this tiny oven?
That's right, yeah. They're made by this signal generator and funneled in through this thin film. You know, you couldn't have a magnetron sitting there or some sort of device sitting there heating the samples.
And is this actually in use, or is this all theoretical? Will we see the world's smallest microwave on the shelves so that laboratories and things can use it quite soon?
Well, unfortunately, not quite yet. They have got a prototype, but it doesn't look like something that you'll be seeing in even labs for a while yet. But they have got money to develop this.
Thanks, Olano. I guess we should probably call that the microwave, shouldn't we? We're now back to this month's chemical conundrum and Wendy's colourful question about fireworks.
My name is Ron Lancaster, and I'm the director and chairman of Kimbolton Fireworks, and I've been specialised in making fireworks for now 30 or 40 years. The question that's been asked is whether there are any colours which cannot be made in fireworks, and of course the clear answer is we can't do black or brown. The real question boiled down in previous times to the fact that most colours were produced from chlorates with low temperature flames, and therefore the only colours which were available were fundamental colours like blue and green, yellow and red, and silver or white. But with the introduction of high temperature flames, which are putting the temperatures up to something more like 1500 degrees with the use of metal powders, particularly magnelium, then you're able to get intermediate colours between those prime colours. If you look at one of those old-fashioned organ consoles, like a Wurlitzer organ where the glass console changed colour as the organist was playing, you'd notice that if it went from, say, green to red, it transformed just at a certain point for just a second or two to a most beautiful orange. And that convinced me that green was really quite an important factor in making a true orange in fireworks. And in the same way, we're able to get some very nice combinations between the blue of copper and the green of barium to give a kind of turquoise. You're able also to then have copper blue and strontium red to give one or two shades of violet. And so that really was the beginning of the sort of colour palette, which you can see now in modern fireworks. So apart from black and brown, we think that we can make almost any kind of colour, though in fact, as with a lot of firework things, it does depend on the distance at which you see it and the atmosphere, which can also contribute to the total effect.
A black firework, what an intriguing idea. Thanks very much to Ron Lancaster of Kimbolton Fireworks for that one. Now, next month, Victoria, you've got a bit of a twist in store for the Chemical Conundrum.
Yes, we do. We have a Christmas competition. We have 10 copies of Simon Vacher and Adrian Dingle's anarchic representation of the periodic table. It's a very fun little periodic table book that comes complete with a poster. And every element is represented by a very funky little cartoon. So we have a question, and if you can guess the element, then you can get a copy of one of these wonderful books, and Mark has the clue for us.
That's right. You have to tell me, who am I? Quick and deadly. That's me. I put the mad in Mad Hatter, and my ability to poison the brain is legendary. A sinister, silver-coloured killer, I am a strange and stealthy liquid metal. But who am I?
So if you think you know what that element is, then please send us an email to chemistryworld@rsc.org.
And Victoria, is it just the first person who comes on to you with the right answer, or have you got a few copies of this?
We've got 10 copies. So
the first 10 right
answers. First come, first serve, yeah.
Okay, sounds intriguing. I might have a go myself. Am I allowed to enter?
No.
So if you can identify that element, write in now. It's chemistryworld@rsc.org. And you can also use that address to send us any feedback or suggestions about this or one of our previous programmes, which was brought to you this month by Mark Peplow, Onano Bhattacharya, Victoria Gill and Richard Van Orden. The production was by Meera Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. From all of us here, have a wonderful Christmas, and we'll see you in the new year. Goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.